Resolute Square.
Welcome to The Zero Line, produced by Resolute Square. I'm Sergeant Sarah Ashton Cirillo of the Armed Forces of Ukraine, and every week we'll be bringing you inside Ukraine's war for liberty and liberation against the Russian enemy, while explaining how a victory by us on the battlefield isn't just vital for the Ukrainian people, but for the world as a whole. We will push back against the lies regarding this war for freedom and take you straight to the front lines of the fight for democracy.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Zero Line with Sarah Ashton Cirillo. I am Lisa Senecal, executive editor of Resolute Square, and I am obviously here with Sarah Ashton Cirillo.
Hey, everyone, especially hey, Lisa. And I know we were always taught when we were younger, don't say hey to anybody, but whatever. We're on the internet. And yeah, it's, a Tuesday morning at 10 a.m. So I'm hoping we can just let it slip and slide by.
Yeah, I think we could be a little informal, a little more formal than we are when we're not recording a podcast, but a little, you know.
Exactly. And I don't know if the viewers are going to see this one, because I know sometimes the video shows up, sometimes it doesn't, but I'm sitting here in gym clothes right now. However, for the Resolute Square audience, for the Resolute Square sponsors, and for just people in general who care about democracy and freedom, one of the reasons I'm in gym clothes is I actually was in my military uniform in Odessa. I'm still in Odessa, but I was in my military uniform because we came under attack last night and into the early morning hours. And so I was finally able to change out of my military gear and get into some gym clothes. And I shared some video with you from that attack last night, Lisa. And
yeah, that was startling. I can't imagine being up close and being able to take the video that you were taking last night, what that must be like. Can you describe a little? It looked intense. Can you describe a little bit of what you shared with me?
Absolutely. And so the audience understands, last week we discussed how the war was still taking place in Odessa, although people are swimming in the beach, people are going into the McDonald's, people are living their life. Last night, 36 Shahed drones were launched from Russian positions across the Black Sea at us in Odessa. Shahed drones are manufactured with technology and parts that were created in Iran. So let there be no mistake what this axis of terror, this axis of, and I hate to use this term, but this axis of evil, let's go a step further, this axis of genocide. What they do in partnership with each other. So these drones are sent at us across the Black Sea, and 36 of them were incoming. What you watched from the vantage point where I was recording was the drones as they were approaching and the counter drone measures that we were utilizing to protect the people of Ukraine. And there's a lawnmower type sound that was clear in the video, that is the hallmark of a Shahed drone, this lawnmower sound as it's going slow through the air. So while these kamikaze drones are very dangerous, they're extremely slow. And we shot down 75% of them last night. Several of them just landed harmlessly. Others hit empty buildings. Ultimately, they truly are suicide drones. They launch them towards us here in Odessa, and they try to overwhelm us. However, Ukrainian Air Force defenses, the people with the anti-aircraft groups, are truly some of the most well-trained professionals in the world when it comes to taking down these incoming, whether they be missiles, rockets, or the drones, as we saw last night. And it was intense. As the audience may know, I have fought at the Zero Line, the name of the show. When you and I discussed it with the principals of Resolute Square, we decided on this name because I have been at the point of contact fighting the Russians up close. Last night was different than what we see with other terror attacks in cities such as Kharkiv or Kyiv, where sometimes a rocket will come down. 1 year ago, Kyiv was hit with a rocket attack that knocked out the power and indicated what our winter was going to be like. This is different. And it's different because it's meant to terrorize. So where the rockets and missiles hit with surprise, These you know are coming. You can almost watch their path across the Black Sea, but you have to let them get close enough to try to take them down. But in doing so, you're also allowing them to get close enough to potentially hit a target. And that's where the masterful training and expertise of our Ukrainian Air Force comes in and air defense systems come in being able to take them down. And so ultimately, at an intensity level, yeah, it was pretty high. You saw, again, to use the term, you saw my vantage point. You saw where I was recording, and you saw a two-minute clip. I was there watching this for several hours, and there's many more clips just like this. It never stopped during that time period. And so ultimately, we were successful in stopping this barrage of suicide drones. We know there's going to be more, and this is why we need to put an end to the Russian terrorism and the Russian threat as soon as possible. They will never stop.
Right. And it was obvious from the sort of indiscriminate way that they were coming in. There is no attempt by the Russian military to hit only military targets. The goal is, as you were saying, to terrorize the population, and it's genocide. It is to kill Ukrainian civilians.
There was a person standing next to me last night, and we were talking about that, and it was Ukrainian. And we were discussing it as we were watching this unfold, and there were many people around us. It was interesting because there was a brief moment, and this person had been in Bucha, and this person had been under occupation in Bucha. So they knew inherently how evil the Russians are. And the person asked, do you think we should move? And it was just tongue in cheek because we knew it didn't matter if we moved or not, simply because the drones are just sent into the city. They're not controlled once they hit our airspace. They will land wherever they end up running out of, wherever they're programmed to end up landing, but due to weather issues, due to battery issues, they can fall anywhere. They can fall into the sea harmlessly. They can loiter in the air a little bit longer. We can knock it down. Or ultimately, they can kill young children, as has happened in Odessa. They can kill grandmothers, as has happened in Odessa. They can land in historical churches, as has happened in Odessa. What we do know, though, is that it is, and you used a word that is finally being recognized by the international community in a legal term, genocide. It is another tool for them to attempt to carry out genocide against the Ukrainian people.
You mentioned Bucha, and for a lot of people who have been following the more than year-long war in Ukraine, that name is absolutely branded in our brains, but not everybody knows what happened there. Can you give a little bit of background about the horror of what was done to the civilian population in Bucha?
Absolutely, and it's timely because of what's happening around the world right now. And Bucha, before I get into it for the audience of Resolute Square and the Zero Line audience, I want to just state that I would not recommend watching videos of Bucha. Go back and read newspapers about it. Don't subject yourself to it. Don't subject yourself to this gore porn, this victim porn that people love to put out there. Understand that the firsthand accounts are the real accounts. So ultimately, when Russia engaged in their full-scale invasion on February 24th, 2022, they began coming in from multiple directions. They crossed into Kharkiv, which is in the northeast. They crossed into Sumy, which is the north central. And then they crossed into the area just north of Kyiv and started coming down the roadways. They reached an area called Bucha, which was an upper-scale suburban enclave of Kyiv, where a lot of upper middle class people had moved to avoid the traffic jams, to be able to have the fresh air to breathe in the countryside on their weekends. And it was a bedroom community. So as many Northeast communities are, that would be what you would have seen popping up around New York City, popping up around Boston, popping up around Philadelphia. You work in the city, you commute 30, 40 minutes, and then you're out into the countryside. The Russians under Vladimir Putin are a jealous, hateful group. So as they rolled into Ukraine, they were shocked by the standard of living. This is not a wives' tale. They were shocked that there were gas stations with coffee makers. They were shocked that people had televisions. And the TDF media unit that I am assigned to, we actually did a full presentation on Bucha called Beyond the Peace. And it was filmed right after deoccupation. I would recommend, there's no gore in it, so I would recommend people watch Beyond the Peace. It's free from the Territorial Defense Forces media, and it's available online. And you have eyewitnesses explaining what the Russians were saying. The Russians couldn't believe how a middle-class person from Ukraine could have a flat-screen TV in their house in Bucha. So as they were planning to roll through Bucha and then on to Kyiv, that's when the resistance really started to pop up. That's when the Territorial Defense Forces, the Armed Forces of Ukraine, the Interior Ministry with the police forces started to battle back. And they were stopped in Bucha, where they couldn't continue any further. And there's some other towns that may be familiar, Borodyanka and Irpin and Hostomel, which are three others. But Bucha is sort of the catch-all name for what I'm about to describe. Ultimately, they got stuck there by their own accord. They couldn't advance any further due to our defenses, but we weren't in position to drive them out. So for approximately 2 months, the residents, such as the person I was speaking with last night that was with me during this attack, were under occupation. And now we understand what being under Russian occupation means. We've seen the reports from Kherson. We've seen the reports from different other areas that have been liberated. Izium, where we found the mass grave of 415 Ukrainian civilians who were murdered and buried in mass graves. And many people still remember what it looks like in Mariupol. Ultimately, however, Bucha was the first place to really remove the scales from the eyes of the Russian devils. We saw how demonic they were. We saw how evil they were. They were raping young girls. We have eyewitness testimony that has been given to The Hague and that has been already accepted into the international criminal courts of soldiers asking the mothers, which daughter will come with us? You choose which one of your daughters is going to become our sex slave. They would indiscriminately murder. So ultimately, it wasn't just, you know, men in their 20s and 30s who they were potentially worried about causing a problem. If a grandfather drove past a tank too quickly, they were shot, summarily executed. And what took place, and I remember this very well, so although I was not in Kyiv and Bucha at the time, I was in Kharkiv, which, as many know from our discussions, was under attack constantly, under siege constantly when this was going on. A journalist friend said to me, "What's going on in Bucha?" I said, "I don't know. I'm in Kharkiv. What's happening?" He said, "Well, we were told to prepare for the liberation, that the Russians had been pushed out, and now we're being stopped. We can't go into the village." So because we hadn't seen the extreme evil and the genocidal practices carried out by the Russians at that point, we had seen them engage in war, we had seen them engage in imperialism, colonialism, but we didn't understand that they were a genocidal monster, that they were a terrorist state and not actually a country anymore as we know it in the global community. I said, "I don't know what's happening. You know, I can't help you here. We're under rocket attack." And again, I blew it off. Next day passes, and I hear from someone else at a much bigger outlet. And so at that point, I asked some questions to folks that I was embedded with here in Kharkiv, and they said, "Well, maybe it's a case where the Russians really weren't pushed all the way out. We had announced it too early. And therefore, they're basically going house to house cleaning up whatever lingering Russians that might be hiding out." And it made sense to me. But again, at that point, we were still fighting in Sumy. We're fighting in Kharkiv. We're fighting Zaporizhia, Kherson. I mean, the country was still under tremendous risk. And we hadn't liberated so many areas as we have now. So we were focused on Kharkiv. And it made sense. And I passed it to the folks in Kyiv, what I knew. We were wrong. Even the military in Kharkiv was wrong. The reason the people were stopped from going in is because there were so many bodies to recover. There was so much death in the streets that it could not be cleaned up in time or covered up in time. So from the announcement of the liberation to the 48-hour period where the journalists could come in, where they still saw the corpses of Ukrainians strewn about the streets, where they still saw dead Ukrainian soldiers who came in from the, and of course, many dead Russians who had been pushed out, but focusing on the civilians, even after 48 hours, they couldn't all be taken off the streets and out of the houses. And ultimately, that's when we understood what genocide meant in 2023. We understood genocide in the early 1990s in places like Rwanda and in Serbia. We understood what the Russians are doing to the Syrians in, you know, the mid-2000s and ultimately, or 2010 to present, 2011, in case anybody calls me out on it, 2011 to present. However, we got our first taste of it here in this war to an extent because so many more Ukrainians were at risk. When comparing it, and you can't compare the brutality of genocide and the population base, but on scale, it's considerably higher in Ukraine than it was in Serbia. And it's still ongoing today. That's one of the issues that we're fighting with from a standpoint of emotions as members of the armed forces of Ukraine and just as Ukrainians themselves. Every day that we wake up not having liberated the country, every day that our partners are not providing us with the equipment we've been promised and that we clearly need in order to finish carrying out this liberation of Ukraine and return to its country's 1991 borders, there are people who are being subjected to rape, murder, torture, and ridicule and humiliation at the hands of the people from the invading forces. And those who die are dying because Russia is trying to wipe out Ukraine as a people. And we knew it for the first time in Bucha. To wrap this up, that's when we had the first hint, and it has not changed since. The Russians don't care. They feel they're above the law. And now they are helping Iran and helping Hamas carry it out in other parts of the world.
We obviously have to talk about what just happened in Israel, the attack, unprecedented attack by Hamas on the Israeli civilian population, kids at a concert, people in their homes. You mentioned Iran just a moment ago and earlier as part of this, you know, this axis of evil between Russia, Iran, and Hamas forces. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
A story came out yesterday in a very large British newspaper addressing my work in the areas of Russian disinformation and specifically how it was shown at NATO. And the reason I'm going with that segue is because I worked on a project yesterday, not forward-facing on it. I was working behind the scenes on it. And that was to get ahead of the lie that Ukrainian weapons have been delivered by Ukraine to Hamas in any sort of capacity. We already were in possession of videos that were created in Russia and then dubbed over and intermixed and edited in with the current war against Israel by Hamas, by Iran, by Russia, in order to blame us for supplying them. So we went ahead and put out the statement that, hey, this is coming, we know it, we have confirmation from our defense intelligence agencies, be ready. Sure enough, it doesn't stop the Russians. 10 o'clock this morning, 11 o'clock this morning, Maria Zakharova, the spokeswoman for the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, Twitter, Telegram, couple of essays, all tied in and back into the ecosystem, talking about how the allegations that we were preparing for had come to fruition. It doesn't stop them. Even when being called out, it doesn't stop them. So first, Russia's taking advantage of it from a disinformation perspective, which on many of these episodes, we have already drilled home the fact, Lisa, that they're not trying to win hearts and minds. They're trying to sow chaos and confusion and fear. So their information warfare policy is not much different than their policy of just recklessly sending in drones. because ultimately it's based off of the notion of terrorism. Second is that Russia, which had been ostensibly acting as a neutral arbiter with Israel and Palestine and doing its best to stop Israel from embracing fully our efforts here in Ukraine at liberty and liberation. Although let me add, and your audience may or may not know this, but I have been on Israeli state television before. I have a wonderful relationship with the Israeli people from my service here in Ukraine. We keep open dialogue from military to military standpoint and from media to media standpoint. So I can assure those who are listening that Israel has provided a significant amount of more of assistance to us than what was being publicly broadcast. However, Russia allowed that veil to fall. They have now called openly for a free Palestinian state, which could be fine. Many people say, let's have a two-state solution. It nearly came to fruition several times. What Russia's done is to call for it based on the 1967 borders. And that's an area that is you're talking about something that's sacrosanct to the Israeli people. Doesn't matter what government happens to be representing the Israeli people, the 1967 borders are non-starter. Russia knows that. So while they're on one hand calling for the 1967 borders, and on the other hand, they're demanding a ceasefire because they don't want anybody to die, they're launching terror attacks against us in hopes of making the world not be able to concentrate, quote, on all of these, breakouts of war. Their big error, though, is in the fact that because we do have a strong working relationship with the Israeli people, our American partners who have been so wonderful both to Ukraine and to Israel have stepped up and said, we're not going to deal with this. The EU has become much stronger in this regard than they have in the past when it comes to what's happening in Israel right now. And they've been a leader when it comes to Ukraine. They're not allowing it to happen. They're not allowing this division and this divisiveness to separate it. And in fact, as you're well aware, Lisa, there's some talk on Capitol Hill, especially from the Senate side, about tying aid packages together that would include Israel and Ukraine. I heard Chairman McCaul at the House today talk about putting together the border security wall, Taiwan, Israel, and Ukraine, and basically just creating a very large package of security. Because ultimately, when the United States can feel comfortable knowing that Russia, Iran, and China are being engaged by Taiwan, by Israel, and by Ukraine, they can look at it as a single issue, because it is about the issue of the United States' defense, and the defense of the United States ties directly in to the spread of democracy around the world. And so while I think we have Iran and Russia causing this outburst of evil, they overplayed their hand and they doubted the strength and resilience of the American people. They doubted the strength and resilience of the American leadership, and they doubted and did not understand the close relationship between Israel and Ukraine.
Right. And you mentioned a couple of minutes ago the two-state solution, and that there are very legitimate arguments for the two-state solution, and we've gotten close a couple of times. But there is a lot of confusion I'm seeing on social media, and I'm sure it's very intentional, equating Hamas's goals to a two-state solution. And that is not what Hamas wants. They do not recognize the right of Israel to exist. They want the complete and utter destruction, dissolving the state of Israel. They are a terrorist organization. They're not a government. They are a terrorist organization that has control of Gaza.
They are a terrorist organization that have proudly and recently gone on Iranian state television talking about exactly what you're stating now, which is that Iran and Hamas and other terrorist organizations from the Middle East not only don't recognize Israel's right to exist, we're going to use this word again. They want to genocide. They want to carry out a modern Holocaust of the Jewish population, the Jewish state, and where Russia is indiscriminately murdering Ukrainians because they have some warped view of Ruski Mir, Russia world, as we've discussed in the past. It's much different in the Middle East for our Israeli allies and partners, where they are under direct threat of being wiped away, not only as a country, not occupied, but in fact, completely liquidated and having any notion of their existence scrubbed from history. And it's startling to think that in 2023, this could still be considered a plausible talking point among terror organizations, that they still can spout this and still attempt to carry this out.
Right, which is, getting back to Ukraine, Russia's goal at this point for the Ukrainian people. This is a genocide. This is not a territorial dispute. This is a genocide. Can you talk a little bit about what the war now between Israel and Hamas means for distraction from what's happening in Ukraine, and how absurd the Russians claim that Ukraine is trying to create chaos in another place, when how incredibly important it is that we stay focused on what's happening in Ukraine, what Russia is doing with this genocide.
Their plan is not going to work, and not just because we put out notice of it. It's not going to work. People are not going to all of a sudden stop thinking that there's a war in Ukraine. And in the long term, we're going to be able to have a much closer working relationship with the Israeli people, with the Israeli Defense Forces, and that will actually force Russia to rue the day when they chose to get involved in this situation in the Middle East. I had a call with a policymaker in Washington, D.C. yesterday, not the one I mentioned offline to you, but somebody else. And we discussed what was being released regarding what we found from the Russian videos, the fake Russian clips of what they were alleging. And the person brought up a great point. The person said to me, yes, the opponents of Ukraine will seize on this. However, it just adds to the pile of lies that they've been throwing out for so long. So they've really gotten to a point of diminishing return. They've blocked Ukraine aid for right now. And what happens? The Senate and the White House are talking about maybe going up as high as 4 times what the original $24 billion was for the first quarter, talking about $100 billion, talking about forcing it through conference. And ultimately, I don't foresee these Russian efforts at disinformation causing more issues for us when it comes to our partners. Because those who don't believe us were already not believing us. And those who understand what's happening are clear-eyed enough to realize, wow, Russia, you're becoming so pathetic that we're seeing right through your videos. And as you said, Lisa.
And that they're willing to escalate things in the Middle East, which is so counter to U.S. security and international security to be attempting to further destabilize a region of the world that is one match away from fighting breaking out on a number of fronts. To know that Russia has a hand in any of this, even if it's through their proxy, Iran, that does not engender them to the American populace, to Western governments, to the U.S. government, considering what funding is going to be to push back against Russia. They're giving more reason to support Ukraine.
Absolutely, they are. And they totally misread, to repeat a point from earlier, and to back up your point, they misread what this area means to the United States and what it means to the United States, not just at a governmental level, but what it means to the United States because of the long-term ties between the people of the United States and the people of Israel. And ultimately, there's some countries in the Middle East that want no part of this. Not only the ones who are our allies, U.S. allies, and helping out, opening up airspaces or allowing refugees in, such as Egypt, but those who are actually speaking through their silence. It's been clear in the last 96 hours that this play by Russia, Iran, and Hamas has backfired. It's come at a tragic loss of life for the Israeli people and civilians who are being killed in Gaza due to the actions of their fellow Palestinians. Let us not make any mistake of that. Innocent civilians don't deserve to die anywhere, especially when it's caused by their own people. And that's what's taking place with any of the deaths happening in Gaza right now. It is all deaths in Israel, whether it's in Gaza, whether it's in Israel proper. Ultimately, it's because of the actions of Hamas. And then further down the line, Iran and Russia. That's who is to blame, not the Israelis.
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned that, because it has been a Hamas tactic to be set up their weaponry in residential areas so that if the Israelis strike back, they're going to hit the civilian population. This is Hamas being willing to sacrifice their fellow citizens to attempt to further their efforts to the goal of dissolving the Israeli state. And we have to, I'm so glad you mentioned it, because we are hearing attempts to blame everyone from the Israelis to President Biden, which is not just insane, it is so disgusting to attempt to take an absolute horror of what just happened to the Israeli people is ongoing. The aftermath of what is now happening both on the Israeli side and the Palestinian side, and use that as a cheap political ploy to try to score points on the blood of innocent people who were, these are the tactics of the sort, and there have been rumors and totally unsubstantiated at this point, but that there was training that happened by the Wagner Group, but it is certainly their tactics, that this is not normal warfare. As awful as war is in any way, this is mass rapes, gang rapes of young women next to the bodies of their fallen friends at a music festival. And this is, it is psychological torture, it's physical torture, and it's against the civilian populace, which, as you were talking about earlier, you know, this is Bucha. This is what the Ukrainian people are facing.
There's not much more to add, except to say that like understands like. Ultimately, whether it's Wagner, Hamas, whether it's the Taliban, whether it's Vlad Putin or the Ayatollah, they're attracted to each other, because where does Russia put their weapons? By churches and by playgrounds. And we know that there's, under the Ayatollah, no moral code of justice or of proper belief in faith, in the way they carry out mass executions without any sort of trial, and they just summarily kill their own people. So it all ties in together.
Stay tuned, everybody. Keep coming back every Thursday for new episodes of The Zero Line with Sarah Ashton Cirillo. Please subscribe to this podcast, Zero Line, everywhere you listen to podcasts. Subscribe to Rick Wilson's The Enemy List podcast, Joe Trippi's That Trippi Show, and tune in every Tuesday evening for the strategy session on Resolute Square. We have an interactive chat that gets pretty spicy and fun. A lot of super smart people who are members of Resolute Square who follow this. So enjoy the chat. And thank you so much, Sarah, for being here, for being in Ukraine, doing everything that you do. And thanks, everybody, for joining us.
I would just wanted to throw one more thing out to the audience. Not only do I appreciate you joining us at The Zero Line, but Lisa and I are always interacting on X. So if you'd like to follow me at Sarah Ashton LV on X. And Lisa, what was your handle for the audience to know?
At LC Senecal.
Perfect. And jump in, ask us any questions. Let us know how bad and genocidal the Russians are, and we will make sure your voice is heard as well.
Absolutely. Thanks, everybody. Also follow us at Resolute Square everywhere. you get your social media. Thanks again, Sarah. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to The Zero Line, a podcast brought to you by Resolute Square. Resolute Square's mission is to inform, lead, and connect. And The Zero Line is one of the tools that followers of Resolute Square can use to fight back against tyranny while championing democracy. Please like and subscribe to The Zero Line wherever you podcast, and follow us on Twitter at Resolute Square or visit resolutesquare.com. Thanks once more for hanging out at The Zero Line.